13 years before the NFL draft this April, a 10-year-old William Hollis wasn't thinking about regional combines, pro days, or whether his phone would ring. He had bigger things on his mind.
I'm 10 years old, 11 years old. I'm watching my uncle. I'm walking in the bathroom, watching my uncle with a rubber band around his arm and a needle in his arm. But that was a normal thing for me. I went back to bed.
For most people, that would be the worst thing that ever happened to them. Something they would forever define themselves as a victim of. Something that would scar their psyche for life. But for William, it was only a bump in what would be a long, tragic, but inspirational road ahead. On today's show, you'll meet two players with, to say the least, non-traditional paths to the draft. From NationalFootballPost.com, I'm your host, Eric Oler. This is Character Guys. William Hollis sees the game on a different level. At 6'1", 245 pounds, he's an average build for a middle linebacker. But within the first 5 minutes of talking to him, I could tell he was different.
Hello?
William, this is Eric Oler from National Football Post. How are you feeling?
How you doing today, sir? I'm doing good. Very well, man.
Good. You nervous? Confident? What's going through your mind right now?
Oh, man. Hopefully praying that I get in the NFL camp, man, and get to showcase my talent, man.
At first, it starts out like any other interview. He starts telling me he's training himself, getting ready for the International Scout Bowl on March 15th in Florence, Alabama. Then I ask about what life was like growing up in Pontiac, Michigan.
Pontiac was a rough life, man. Like I said, man, my mother was she was on heroin, and you know, I had my brother and my older sister, and and, you know, in Michigan, you know, the way we take care of our family is, you know, sad to say, but it's through crime. You know, I had to do a lot of stuff that, you know, I had never went to jail. You know, unfortunately, never got caught doing any of the things I did. But I had to do a lot of ungodly things, you know, to feed my brother and my sister and, you know, make sure everything was okay. You know, my mom was on welfare, so she did the most she could, you know, for us. But, you know, sometimes, you know, I go stay at a friend's house just to get me a square meal that night. And if my brother don't eat, you know, I save half my meal and I give half of that, you know, to my brother and sister. You know, it was just, I didn't live the life that, you know, a kid wasn't supposed to live, but, you know, you got to make a way.
There's much more to his off-the-field story that we get to later. But first, I asked how he got involved with football.
I started playing football when I turned 13 years old. Basically, a counselor, anger management counselor, had introduced me to the game. And she got in touch and got in touch with my auntie and one of my uncles. And they had took me up to a park and got me registered. And at first, I wasn't going to be able to play until I went out there and practiced. And the coach got my helmet and my shoulder pads, so he creased everything after he saw me play. I just had a lot of anger, and it was a natural sport for me. It was a release in a way for me to stay out of trouble. So when I first got introduced to it, I fell in love with it right away. I started thinking that one day my coach came up to me and he told me, Hollis, he said, I know your situation. And he said, you could change your whole family life, change your mother life, your grandmother life, everybody's life, if you stick to this and dedicate your life to this game. And I believe that, you know, coming from where I'm from, football was do or die for me. It was a clock going off in my head. You know, I got to save my mother's life. My mother was miserable. She couldn't do the things that she wanted to do for us, and I saw it on her face. And I could tell that she really wanted to, but I learned that, you know, being on heroin, that's not a choice. That's an addiction. That's a disease, you know what I mean? And it's hard to just let it go.
William's mother battled a lot of demons. She was molested as a child by her father and was often in the same position as William, young and taking care of her siblings.
You know what I mean? It was basically like a cycle, and it was coming off back on me and my sister and my brother, you know, but I was destined and I was driven to say, I'm going to change my family situation. And every day, you know, I step on the field, that's my mentality. I got to get better, and that clock's still ticking.
William bounced around between foster homes, living with his grandmother and his mother. After dominating community college for 2 years, he eventually gets to Division II school, Clark Atlanta. His stats there are great. In only 8 games in 2009, he had 78 tackles, 5 forced fumbles, 14.5 tackles for loss, 3.5 sacks, and 2 interceptions. He's nominated for the Harlan Hill Trophy, the Division II equivalent of the Heisman. All the while, his mother continues struggling with her addiction back home in Pontiac.
I didn't know how I went on some days, but I knew that it was worse where I came from than where I was at. So I felt like this clock is ticking. Let me beat this clock. You feel me? Let me try to be successful down here and get taken care of, you know, by these coaches and by this school. And whatever I got, I can send it to my mother. It's better for me to be there, to be struggling with her, and it was better for me to be away so I can send money to her. You know, I can take care of her.
He sent his financial aid refund checks to his mother, along with money he'd make doing odd jobs he could find when he had the time.
I was in college, you know what I mean? She would call me and she would say, it's cold in the house. I don't have no money to turn the heat on, or I'm hungry. And it's a messed up feeling. You're a kid in college, you eating 3 square, 4 square meals a day, and your mother not eating anything, and I'm all the way in Atlanta. What can I do? I'm taking refund checks, and I'm sending a whole check to my mother, you know, not knowing if she's using it to buy dope or she's using it, you know, to get something to eat or do the things she needed to do. But unfortunately, man, I was put through that situation, and that was pretty much been my whole life.
Despite on-the-field success, his personal life was spiraling out of control.
At this time, one of my girlfriend down at Clark Atlanta was pregnant. She was from Boston. She was getting ready to graduate. At this point, I grew up without a father, so I'm thinking I want to be better than what, you know, my father was to me, and I'm going to be a father. So Clark Atlanta was wild for me. Like I was living reckless, out of control, and I was losing the fight the reason why I even came this far. You know, I was starting to forget where I came from and what happened, and the reason why I chose a fight to be in college.
Until one day, he gets an anonymous phone call.
You know, they say you need to get to a bigger university, and they mentioned North Alabama's not too far from there, and they hung up.
Not one to question fate, William contacted Coach Terry Bowden at North Alabama and arranged a visit. He loved it. It was a smaller town with fewer temptations, but a bigger school, a bigger stage. It's exactly what his life needed. He was brought in on a full scholarship, even though it meant sitting out a year before he could play. He flew to Boston to be with his girlfriend for the birth of their daughter, when his life took yet another unexpected turn.
Literally, the next day, her mother left the hospital. We get a call like 15, 20 minutes later that she was in a car accident and she was paralyzed from the waist down. This was what changed my whole life. They made me, basically, I went back to Terry Bowden, and my girlfriend, she's my fiance now, she had to get taken in custody of her brother and her sister. So basically, she took them in, and she said she needed help, because she also just had my daughter, and I had to make a man decision. So I told Coach Bowden, I'm apologizing. Coach Bowden tried to bring them down there, you know, get daycares and all this other stuff for them, but Her mother needed her help also. She needed to be there. So I made the decision I had to leave. Basically, the biggest school I ever been to, the biggest opportunity I ever got, I had to leave it. And this wasn't because because I wanted to. It's because I had to. You know what I mean? It was a man decision.
William took a job working at a hospital to help support his girlfriend's family and his newborn daughter, Halo. He was determined not to become a statistic, to break the cycle of pain and struggle, to chart a new course for his family.
I'm trying to save my mother's life, and I'm trying to save these two kids' life and my daughter's life by helping provide for them. So I'm 21 years old, and this is what I'm facing with. This is what I'm faced with. I'm not really feeling too well. I'm sad every day, but I'm blessed. I'm happy to be alive, and I'm happy to be around these kids. But at the same time, you know, I was just trying to hold on.
Things started getting better. William's girlfriend's mother was making progress. His girlfriend graduated college and got a job. Then he got a call from his former coach at Clark, Keith Higdon. Here's Coach Higdon, now an offensive line coach at Tuskegee.
You know, he called and basically just to see what was going on. I told him I can't promise him a scholarship, but I can promise him an opportunity to come out here and just play his skills and do what he do best.
To get back in shape, William pays a visit to his cousin, former wide receiver Sam Rogers in California. There, he's working out with some NFL greats like Isaac Bruce and Cornelius Bennett.
2 weeks into that training, I get a call saying that my mother, my 38-year-old mother, passed away in a drug house on a couch. Passed away of a heroin overdose. 38 years old, my best friend, my heart, my everything. I felt like life couldn't get more lower than that. And it broke me down to the point where I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I went to sleep that night and I had this crazy dream. Man, I ain't never told nobody about that. This crazy dream. I'm laying on the couch and I have a dream of this thing, this ram with horns on it, and I'm laying on the couch. And I feel like something came on my back in, like, and I'm asleep, though. But the dream seems so real. I'm in a straight-out, full-fledged sweat. And I hop up, and I break down crying. And that next day, after I cried, I felt better. You know what I mean? And I called my coach, and I said, I'm coming. He said, remind you, I don't got no place for you to stay. And I don't got and you figure it out. And we're going to work away. But I'm an underdog. I'm used to this. So I went down there. I slept sleeping on the floor of a teammate. And I make it through camp. I barely made it through camp. I was out of shape. Still getting in shape. I stopped working out because I had to fly to Michigan to bury my mother. But I came down there with 3 weeks clothes in a duffel bag. No money. No scholarship. Slept on my teammate floor. I made it to the spring. And I dominated. Earned a full scholarship.
William didn't play much his 1 year at Tuskegee. The details of why vary depending on who you talk to. But by the end of the year, William left feeling hurt and emotionally drained. He turned in his pads before the end of the season.
I had endured so much that my heart was broken. And I didn't even know myself. It was like I was questioning God, like, why? Like, I worked so hard. I came here out of shape, nothing, after burying my mother with no scholarship, and you gave me a full scholarship. And then they hit me with this. I left and I started looking for jobs. I got a job at a dealership selling cars. I thought this was going to be my new future. You know, everything I ever did, I put my all into it. And I always see the expectation. I sold a car my first week, and they didn't expect me to sell my first car until a month. I sold my car in my first week, and one day an employee told me, he watched my film, he read about me, he said, man, you're too young to give up. And I looked at him in his eyes, he said, you're too young to get up, and you're too talented, and you got a story to tell. Fight for what you believe in.
While his story's great, what I and NFL scouts will eventually want to know is, can he still play? Clayton Banner, AFL and CFL coach.
Hollis is a good motor. I'm sure he will test well. The young man has, I mean, he's, you look at him on film, you know, he has everything you want. Size-speed ratio that's good. He runs well. He's aggressive, and he's a good guy.
Again, Tuskegee assistant Keith Higdon.
He gets an opportunity just to get a chance against somebody at camp. He's going to open some eyes.
And if you need more convincing, there's no one better than William himself.
I've always wanted to play this game. I always wanted to be one of the best football players to ever grace a football field. And people think I dream so big. But why not? Why not dream big? If you feel like you've been the chosen one, you've been the one. My mother used to call me the chosen one. She used to say, you're the one going to take us out of this poverty. You're the one going to take us out of hell. Because where I'm from, you can put your hand on the concrete, on the ground, and you can touch the devil's fingertips. That's how evil it is from where I'm from. Murders. Every best friend I got, dead. They're gone. I got one friend left. He's serving 100 years in prison for murder. He deal me 15 years old. I talked to him 3 days ago. He told me that the only reason I ain't killed myself is because I keep reading great things about you. And when he told me that, I said, it will never be another man that stopped me. That's what I bring to any team, to any table. I'm going to play the game like my life depends on it, because it does. And the life of my best friend depends on it, and my daughter and my brother. It's all about effort. That's what this game's about. Who don't quit on a play? I won't quit on a play. You feel me? When I'm hurting, if my arm broke or my wrist broke or my fingers broke, I think about some kids in the neighborhood that probably ain't got a meal that night. I think about some kids in the neighborhood who got a cold but can't get cough medicine. Right now, I'm in the PIFL football team with the Columbus Lions. I came down here. It was three NFL guys, former NFL players, that came to this team to try for defensive end. And guess where two of them at? They're at home because I took their spot. They played here last year. Just for me to get in shape, because I don't got nobody training me. Just so I can go against NFL caliber linemen, I came down here and I'm the starting DN this Sunday for the Columbus Lions. I'm the starting DN. It's because I believe in myself. I don't care. It don't matter where you're from. Football players come from all walks of life. I'm just trying to prove myself. I don't got the traditional path to the draft. I gotta grind. But you know what? I wouldn't have it no other way.
So out of all this stuff that's motivating you, what's the one biggest thing when you're beat tired and you want to hit the weights or you want to go for a run or something? What's the biggest thing that motivates you?
Is being able to walk outside of my own free will, not having no man waking me up in the morning or telling me when to go to sleep. Being out of prison, being alive, that's one thing I'm thankful for. Because my friend is dead. My best friend in heaven, my mother. I deal with that. Just before this interview, I was thinking about it. I was thinking about what she would be thinking, what she would be saying, you know, reading about her son, you know, reading about her story. This game, to some of us, is life, you know what I mean? Like, this, I'm no different than any other inner city kid. But I'm different in the fact that I persevered through what I persevered through. And I remember days when I used to come into dope. I used to sneak out my grandma's house and go to dope houses and watch over my mama for the whole night. And I'm 15, 14 years old doing this. I'm watching over her. She giving me a kiss. She hold me. She telling me she's sorry. Why she on dope? Why she high? She telling me she's sorry. I want to give back. I want to feed a kid that ain't got nothing to eat. I want to give a kid to design the shoes he never had. You know, I want to give a kid because I know where they're coming from. I know the feeling when nobody supports you, when nobody comes to your game, when nobody says that you could be anything you want to be, when people passing you bags of dope saying you want to make some money. The difference between me, nobody had to teach me this. They gave me the bag of dope and I threw it back at them.
Does anything scare you about maybe about succeeding, about achieving that dream?
Nothing at all. The only thing scares me is not succeed. Nothing scares me. Nothing scares me, man. Nothing. I'm 10 years old, 11 years old. I'm watching my uncle. I'm walking in the bathroom, watching my uncle with a rubber band around his arm and a needle in his arm. But that was a normal thing for me. I went back to bed.
What's the solution for that? What's the solution for people like your mother who struggled with that?
We gotta talk. We gotta talk to them more. You know, we gotta know people's stories. You know what I mean? And when I tell you one situation where my mother had a job at a hospital, and she used to smile so big just because she could go buy a Hungry Howie's pizza for her family and bring that home to us, and we can eat as a family. That was ours. That was the most precious thing to us as a kid. That, you know, some kids go to Disneyland, some kids go everywhere. But, you know, my mom worked a job, and they let her go because she didn't have an education. She didn't have an education, but she was the best dang little nurse they had over there. Everybody loved her, but they just fired her. And I feel like America's so cold, man, when they give to the people who are not grateful, but take away from the people that is grateful. Mm. And when that job took that job away from mom, it took her soul. She couldn't support us. She couldn't give us everything no more. So it kept her confident. And you know, it just made me emotional because, you know, I miss her, man. And now that I'm going through, I do it for her, and she, you know, I know she can see me. She can't see me. I can't touch her. I can't call her no more, you know? And that's all I had. I don't got nobody else, you know? That's the only people I had. And my daughter and my wife now, you know, that's the only people I had. But my best friend, the only woman I know, I'd never see her again. My dream was to come out of NFL tunnel and see my mom in the stands. I never had that, you know. I never get that, and you know, when I step on the field, man, that's the only thing I'm thinking about. Making her proud. She watched me from the sky, and I'm gonna make her proud no matter what league, what wherever I'm at. I will be great, and I'm gonna be the best that they ever seen, or one of the best they ever even mentioned. I'm gonna dominate because it's bigger than me. I don't do this for me. I do this for people like my mother, women like my mother, kids like me. And that's what keep me. That's what keep me smiling and keep me on my feet and keep my head up.
For the last three decades, Pontiac, Michigan has seen a violent crime rate four times that of the national average. Drug abuse rates are much higher too. William Hollis is now 23, playing linebacker for the Columbus Lions of the Professional Indoor Football League. He had two sacks this weekend in his debut against the Knoxville Nighthawks. Columbus won the game 58-28. He'll be playing in the Progress International Scout Bowl on March 15th in Florence, Alabama, and the ProBound Sportswear Florida Bowl in Daytona Beach on March 23rd. If he makes a team, he wants to start a foundation for mothers struggling with drug addiction and make enough to put his daughter Halo, now two, through college. You can follow him on Twitter, @HalosDaddy51.
Well, we all knew things had to get better if we kept acting rational and sane. Now I can see the clouds on the horizon. Bad times are coming around again.
Coming up, from Kentucky to Iraq to Montana to draft day, 30-year-old former Marine Brandon O'Brien's story. Stay tuned. Since he started playing in a Pop Warner League in seventh grade, Brandon O'Brien knew he wanted to play in the NFL. He didn't know how long it would take, but that never mattered to him.
Even little kid playing flag football, you know, I'd always watch games with my dad on Sundays, and my dad, watching games with my dad on Sundays was really like a learning session. It wasn't just to watch the game. He'd always point things out. I can remember even at a young age, and then especially more in high school when we'd watch college football on Saturdays and pro on Sundays. It would almost be like study sessions in a sense. I mean, it was enjoyable, but it was learning at the same time.
And this is before the advent of DVR. Like, I can imagine nowadays he would be like pausing and rewinding and being like,
"Oh yeah, for sure." Thank goodness there wasn't DVR back then, so I'd be in trouble.
A 6'1", 218-pound wide receiver, Brandon graduated University High School in Orlando. Though the offense was focused on the run, he put up decent numbers. Still, he wasn't on any Division I radars.
I had my senior season in high school, and we were a pretty dominant running team. Quarterback really wasn't that good. We didn't throw the ball a lot, but I wanted to go play Division I football and as a receiver, and my dad's like, "Well, you know, you get the grades, walk on somewhere."
That somewhere ended up being Kentucky. Brandon walked on to a team that had just produced Heisman Trophy finalist Tim Couch.
At the time, the University of Kentucky had Hal Mumme, and Tim Couch just got drafted a year before, and they were just going 4 and 5 receiver sets, throwing the ball, just like the Florida Gators and Steve Spurrier back then. And so I chose the University of Kentucky. I wanted to kind of go away from home, and chose to walk on there, and I played on the JV squad on Thursday nights against D2 teams and NAIA teams, and I practiced all week with the varsity squad. And it was there where I really started to think, you know, I could play. At 18, I was going up against Eric Kelly and Marlon McRae, who played in the league. They got drafted that year. And I was kind of running by Eric Kelly. You know, he would always be like, "Wow, man, you're really pushing me for an 18, you know, year old walk-on." And when he said that, and then I watched him play for the Vikings for a couple of years, I was like, you know, hey, keep working hard, you never know.
In an eerie parallel to our first story, when Brandon's family ran into trouble financially, he made the decision to leave school and help them out.
I left at the semester's end and went home. I got a job with Coca-Cola, and I got a job with Abercrombie & Fitch as a manager there at that store in Orlando. And, it just helped out with family situation at the time. Family always came first for me, and I always prayed that I'd have an opportunity to play football again at some point in time, so I continued to work out.
Did your family ask you for help, or did you kind of force them to take your help?
It was kind of more of saying, just, you know, let me do this. I mean, you helped raise me for, you know, 18, 19 years. It's the least I could do is come home and help, you know. And I knew I would finish my education, and even though I wanted to stay and play football, like I said, I couldn't be away and then, you know, think of the situation that was going on back at home.
But did you ever see that as maybe – obviously not now, but at the time, were you ever thinking to yourself that your window might be closing, that you might not have, that this might be giving up
on
your dream?
I never thought of it as giving up, but I definitely thought, wow, now the window's even smaller because, you get out and then people are skeptical. Even if you've been working out, I mean, you've been playing 4 years of high school football, you know, boom, make the transition right into college. And now I'm at home doing what I'm doing, but I want to get back and play. So now I'm thinking, well, the window's smaller. Coaches, when I go to talk to them again, I'm going to be skeptical. I've been out of the game a little bit, so to say. So, but honestly, I really wasn't worried about it at the time.
After a few years, Brandon had a calling in his heart to serve his country, and he joined the Marine Corps in 2005. Over the next 4 years, he'd served 2 tours in Iraq. Is football even on your mind during those years?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Heck yes. We talked to anybody that, you know, I was in the unit with, and I'd always be working out, going to the track, running. Even though I knew for basically 4 years I wouldn't have a chance to play, by the end of those 4 years, I didn't know where I might be as far as the college goes, but I knew I wanted to be prepared to play college football again. Even in Iraq, we'd come back from patrols, and I would go to the weight room. No matter what time of day it was, I would go lift. And then I'd go take a nap and get ready for the next patrol.
After his second tour, Brandon was stationed in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. On an early evening beach patrol one day, Brandon describes what happened next.
And lifeguards are, you know, taken off duty at 6, so it's a swim after your, at your own risk type of thing after 6 o'clock at night on the beach. So it was around 7:30 or so. The sun was pretty much almost down, and all of a sudden we were walking out of the office and people were screaming for help. So we ran to the end of the pier where we were at and down the beach about 70, 100 yards, and there was an offshore storm system in the area that week, and I know all the lifeguards, because I had some friends that were lifeguards, that they were warning people to undertow and stuff like that, but apparently two Marines got swept out, and they couldn't get back in. So all the lifeguard gear, flotation devices and whatnot, are locked up when the lifeguards leave the beach. So we had no key as a beach patrol to get in there. And so my friend was like, let's call 911. And I was like, by the time, you know, paramedics get out to the beach where we are, who knows, the sun's going to be completely down. We don't know what's going to happen. And he was like, you can't go in there. There's no way you're swimming a whole football field out there, over those waves in the dark. You don't have to see. And I was like, well, I got to try. I can't just let them sit out there, so I wouldn't want someone, you know, if I was out there, I wouldn't want someone to come try to help me. So he said he was going to go try to unlock the flotation device, the lifeguard locker, and I just kicked my shoes off, went in the water. And honestly, I don't remember a lot of thinking. I just know I was trying to get over the waves. And at some point, you know, stop for a minute and try to find my bearing and find out where they were. But there was a couple times I was pushed down by waves under the water, and I would go to push against the sand, the floor, to push myself to the surface again. And there was one time where I went to push off the bottom of the ocean, and I couldn't push off. That's how deep I was out there. Oof. And that was a very scary feeling, honestly. But then I finally got to the guys, and one was trying to hold the other up, basically, and that's what happened. One had started to get swept down, and the other one went to go after him, and then, you know, they both were fatigued from swimming. And I got near them, and, you know, I tried to calm them down without them grabbing onto me and pulling me under. So I just told them they had to relax, you know, they were going to turn around, and I was going to grab them. And I was going to, kick back, and we're going to try to end up catching waves back in eventually. And that's what we ended up doing. I grabbed them both, and we ended up catching waves about 50 yards back toward the shore and riding them in. And then once we got in, knee-deep water, my partner was on the beach again, and he helped me pull. He pulled one guy off my shoulder and leg, and I had the other guy help him to the beach. By the time the paramedics were running down the beach, and, yeah, one of the guys went into shock, and they had to medevac him to a regional hospital, apparently.
Brandon was awarded the Navy and Marine Corps Medal. It's the highest non-combat decoration awarded for heroism, and an honor previously awarded to John F. Kennedy and Navy diver Carl Brashear. Quoting a citation, Corporal O'Brien displayed unflinching responsiveness during imminent, life-threatening circumstances, thereby reflecting great credit upon himself and upholding the highest traditions of the Marine Corps. With his service complete, Brandon decided it was time to return to the game he loved and the dream he never stopped believing in. Unfortunately, he no longer had any Division I eligibility. He found that the eligibility rules differed for NAIA schools, and he still had 3 years to play.
I did some research and found out that the Frontier Conference was put out the national champion for a number of years, Carroll College. And that's apparently where and I had some of the best competition, so I was like, you know what? I started sending stuff out to all the Frontier Conference schools, and Montana State Northern showed me the most, you know, interest, And they were just coming off a down year, and he was willing to take a chance on me, head coach Mark Sampson up there, and his son Kyle, who's the offensive coordinator. And I was grateful, you know, sir. I was just really just trying to play again. I had a fire for it. I felt like it was unfinished business, and I was going to give my all to any program that allowed me to.
He was even able to save them a scholarship to use on another player thanks to the GI Bill program paying his way. This year, he broke school records for 3 touchdowns in a game, 226 yards receiving in a game, and 11 touchdowns on the season. O'Brien was literally a man amongst boys and was voted first team All-Frontier Conference. Does anything scare you about succeeding?
Not at all, sir. Not at all. I know what I would do with the money. I know if I am, like I said, fortunate enough to play in the NFL and get some money, the Wounded Warrior Project is something that's really near and dear to my heart, and I want to devote a lot of my time and donations to, as far as that goes. I just want to help people. I want to be able to play a game for a living and, you know, be able to tell my parents they don't have to work anymore. That'd be wonderful to do. But also, like I said, devote my time and money to the Wounded Warrior Project and troops and their families, because, like I said, that's the most near and dear thing in my heart, honestly. I'm doing this for my friends in the Marine Corps. I'm doing this for my friends that have passed away on deployment since I've gotten out. I'm doing this for my family, the O'Brien name, and I got a lot of pride in this journey I've been on. So I tell you what, I'm going to do everything I can to make it happen and to be successful. Failure isn't an option for me. And like I said, I just need one opportunity to show, one team to show interest in me out of all the other teams, just one, and I'll film it. You know, they're getting their money's worth, and they're getting a quality human being to be a part of their organization.
Now 30, Brandon is training at Athletes Performance in Frisco, Texas. He can be seen at the Montana State Pro Day in Bozeman on March 18th. The Wounded Warrior Project serves veterans and service members who incur injury and illness in their service and their families. With advancements in battlefield medicine and body armor, an unprecedented percentage of service members are surviving severe wounds or injuries. For every U.S. soldier killed in World Wars I and II, there were 1.7 soldiers wounded. In Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom, for every U.S. soldier killed, 7 are wounded. If you'd like to contribute to the Wounded Warrior Project, you can visit www.woundedwarriorproject.org. For more information on Brandon O'Brien and William Hollis, please visit our website, nationalfootballpost.com. There you'll find our interview with Stony Brook defensive end John Coates, links to the music you heard on today's show, and over 300 draft prospect grades and scouting reports. If you like what you heard today, please tweet it, like it, share it, and get it out there. If you'd like to contribute to the show, contact us at information@nationalfootballpost.com. We'll be back next week with more on and off the field stories from this year's crop of draftees. From National Football Post, thank you for listening.